Slacker Podcast. Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers. You are very welcome to the Slacker Podcast. I hope your Christmas records are spinning at the appropriate speed and that your puddings are soaked in brandy. I, myself, am not soaked in brandy, but we're getting to that time that I probably will be. My name is Phil Taggart. I am an Irish broadcaster. I've got a couple of shows on Radio 1, should you want to go and listen to lots of strange and wonderful new music every single week. I've bearded up for Christmas, and I feel pretty good about myself. I'm not one of these people that could generally normally grow a beard, but I've obviously reached that point in my life where the hair is like falling off the top of my head, but it's growing everywhere else. I've just finished writing my book, The Slacker's Guide to the Music Industry, which is going to come out next year. And I thought, right, if you're going to finish writing a book, you've got to go in full pretentious author with it. You got to get a beret. Haven't got that yet. Get a polo neck t-shirt. Haven't got that yet either, but I've got the full on winter beard going on. This week we have got Churches on the podcast. They are the salvation of synth pop from Scotland. One for the alliteration fans there. They have laid down three albums of pure interest in pop music on us at that point, and it was just great to have two-thirds of Churches in for a little chinwag. We recorded this way back in May as well, so I mean, we've had this one sitting in the vault for a little while. They're just an absolutely incredible band, and we got through so much of their actual recorded music and so much of the things that like they wanted to get off their chest and some of the things I wanted to ask them as well. And before we get into the full podcast, I just want to let you know that this week's podcast is sponsored by The Economist. The Economist magazine is something, before I actually read it, before I actually got into it, I thought it was associated with like those sort of pinstriped suited men and women of the stock exchange. You know, the ones that use like all sorts of language that you have no idea. Kind of like the Wolf of Wall Street. That's, I'd imagine those people like read The Economist. And then they were like, right, we want to sponsor your podcast. And I decided, right, okay, right, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to have a good old read of what's going on it. And do you know what? I couldn't have been further from the truth. This week, I was reading about the rise and fall of Christmas music and how the albums that are made by middle-aged people for middle-aged listeners. And to be fair, that's true enough, because I've been trying to find Christmas music for my shows at the moment, and nobody in any way of any youth is making any Christmas records. What are you guys doing? There's so much money to be made out there. So I thought that was pretty interesting this week in The Economist. For your free print copy of The Economist, just text Slacker to 78070. That is Slacker to 78070. And you could have a beautiful Economist magazine in your hand. Okay, right, let's get into it now. And just a word of warning before we start this podcast. This is the only one in series one where we don't have a demo from the band, but we have every other nugget of information that we really need. It's a really good listen. This is the Slacker Podcast with Churches in three,
in two, in one.
How's it going? We've got Ian and Martin. I can barely see you behind these posture.
I know.
I'm just trying to sit up straight. I'm trying to work on my posture.
You need to set up some mirrors, angled mirrors. That would work. Yeah.
Exactly. If I'm going to like grill you hard over like the next 5-6 hours, it is, because it's going to be. No, it's not.
We don't have Lauren to protect us. She's sick, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. What's up with Lauren?
She's just really overtired. I run down from all the singing and that.
Early mornings flights. You know the stuff. It's been a pretty grueling couple of weeks.
I mean, like, I can barely even form a sentence when I've been on a flight for an hour, because that like recycled air kind of gets it can't be good for your voice, can it?
No, it's brutal.
Pretty bad. Can we swear and stuff, by the way?
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah.
It's fucking awesome.
Have you done so many interviews now?
So many, and you just can't say anything.
Oh, I've been getting in trouble because
surely at this stage, three albums in, you're not still swearing on the radio.
Yeah, well, she's had two this weekend.
I know.
It was really one big weekend, and she's like, I'm trying not to fuck it up. And then yesterday in Radio 5 Live, she said, shitty.
I know.
I mean, there's worse things that have happened out there, really, isn't there?
Right. I just wanted to, hopefully there's no complaints, you know, you get kicked off for that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah, well, like, I've seen it from the other side before, where, like,
fans will come on at Big Weekend and they'll say, oh, there's absolutely no swears in the music whatsoever. And then they'll swear loads, or there'll be like a track which's got a backing track. There's a lot of backing tracks at Big Weekend, and it'll just be fuck this and shit. We're going to have to pull this one off the air.
Oh, come on.
So I think, in the grand scheme of
things. It's only words.
Yeah, exactly. It's not too bad. I'm sure you've done worse in interviews at the beginning.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. You catch the wrong people at the wrong time, and they will say anything.
What's the worst thing that you've like slapped your head after saying it and gone, oh God, why did I say that?
Can I just bring up the time that we got dumped off a radio broadcast in America because you said shit?
Oh yeah, I mean, that's not really that bad, is it? But at the same time, it was a live broadcast. It was a kind of high profile
don't say fuck
station. In the States, and they dumped the whole show because they couldn't bring it back once it was gone. And I just said, oh, I thought it was some shit. And they were like,
you serious?
Oh my God.
We're off the air. Middle America
was out burning churches directly afterwards.
Martin's had one, Lawrence had one, it's my turn now.
You're really well behaved. I just like, whenever there's a technical problem, we turn to Ian and try and get me to do his heavy metal voice.
I guess it's not even just really the swearing, is it? It's like the... Because you get asked hard questions quite a lot. You're obviously going to sometimes just go, right, here we go. And you just say something and then it'll be picked up by like Enemy or Pitchfork or something like that. That's happened to you quite a lot.
Yeah.
But normally on the more worthy side of things.
Remember there was the Linkin Park guy?
Oh, Mike Shinoda.
And you just called him a pointless dick or something like that.
No. I said what he said in that interview was a pointless dig.
Oh yeah, and that really got picked up as Ian calling him a pointless dick, and it started this feud between him and us for some weird reason.
I like a comedy feud though. It's kind of like lightweight and frivolous.
As somebody who's like music is based around playing other bands and being interested in it.
Right.
I would open up a butchery because I love the beef so much.
Yes. Yeah. It's fun. It's a bit of colour,
A bit of beef's great. What did Mike Shinoda ping you back at?
Well, you know, he started it. He said something about, I'm sick of all the Disney shit on this Disney sounding shit on alternative radio, like churches. I want to get back to like rock music or whatever. I assume because he was trying to get a rock song playlisted at the time.
Yeah, of course.
And he was like, we found out... interviewer brought it up to us, which is how this started.
Uh-huh.
And then we like made a 5-hour mega mix on YouTube where I like took the intro to My Sharona and changed it to Mike Shinoda and just had it loop for hours and hours and hours.
We made a little GIF that had Mike saying
Mike Shinoda.
We had a little GIF with him saying I love churches, like flashing up.
And that was the end of it.
It was juvenile stuff, but it was fun.
Well, I think the best way to come back at something like that is you either have to come back on really the more, take the sort of the higher step, or come back and just go way lower.
Yeah. That's what we did.
I'm capable of real depth.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you haven't reached that point in your career yet where Noel Gallagher's come after you.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't go up against him.
I did a podcast with Will Fallis recently, and I think they had some choice words for Liam Gallagher. It's almost like you're doing well if one of like the sort of grumpy...
Yeah.
Grumpy Gallagher brothers come after you.
You know, I wouldn't go up against them because they're sharp, those boys. They'll get you.
They're hard as well.
Man, they grew up on a council estate in Manchester. You have to be smart because people from Manchester are witty and they're clever, and especially when you're on a council estate, you're on your wares the whole time.
That's the training ground. I mean, I grew up in a council estate in Glasgow.
It's pretty similar. Well.
it's really evolve or die.
I grew up like right beside one in Oma, and I perfected the walk. Right, when you're going past the council estate, right? Like, I lived just right on the edge of it, and the guys who are about the same age as me would be they'd be the sort of bad kids, and I wouldn't. Like, I was just like sort of, I just want to get on with my business. But they were the boys who were going to knock everybody shit in.
Yeah.
So what you have to do is you have to kind of like peacock yourself up,
yeah, puff and the chest and not shoulders
look
back.
Not look like you're scared, yeah. Even though inside you're like, please don't say anything. Please don't say, where are you going, you wee dick?
Where are they now, though?
One is NASA. The other one runs Mensa.
Are you fucking serious?
No.
That would be really so cool. Gullible. I know. That'd be a really good story, though. He's like rocket scientist. Well,
one of them is now Elon Musk.
Yeah. You might have heard of him.
He's Grimes' boyfriend. Yeah, totally.
Listen, we'll take it out of the red tops for a minute, because I want to go back to the very beginning and talk about, like, you know, how you got into music in the first place, and the first sort of little eureka moment, the little bulb that went off in your head, and you heard a record or a track or a relative playing guitar or something, and you were just like, right, this is for me.
Oh, you mean way back?
Yeah, way back. Early days.
I know the moment. Completely. My aunt and uncle were like a duo with like a backing band that played in Butlins.
Oh, right.
No, they were.
Yeah, they did.
Butlins, covers. To anybody who is listening to this outside of the UK, is the leading holiday park for, I'm trying to get the voiceover for it, the leading holiday park for families and fun entertainment.
Do you do voiceovers?
I don't know, not really.
You'd be quite good. Yeah. Sounds good.
I got asked to do a voiceover once for a certain mayonnaise company.
Okay.
No.
I think I was just asked to do a tryout for it. I don't think I was actually asked to do it.
Right.
And it was like, Smellman's creamy mayonnaise.
And they were like, we'll call you.
It's not right.
That's so good.
So your auntie and uncle were in a duo. What sort of music were they making?
They were making, well, I guess now I realise that my auntie was really into Fleetwood Mac, because it was like, that was the vibe, and she kind of sounded a bit like Christine McVie.
Mm. Wow,
and
right,
they did all these covers, and she actually has an amazing voice even still. But my initial motivation for going to Butlins with them, which I used to do with my cousin.
Birds?
No, I was like 12 or some shit. I wasn't birds. Thinking about birds at 12.
Come what?
On. Just relax. was to play the arcades, because they had the Simpsons arcade machine.
The four player?
The four player.
Yeah, I know the exact game. That was the one where you could play as Bart Simpson and you'd have a skateboard and you had to hit everybody with the spinning skateboard.
It was kind of like the X-Men four player game.
Yep.
And like Streets of Rage and all those, wasn't it? It was like a kind of scrolling beat 'em up.
I was mad for that game.
Yeah.
But in doing that, I kind of eventually was like, it's pretty cool what they're doing up there as well.
Yes, that's not too bad. Yeah, I might get into that.
And they loaned me a guitar.
Uh-huh.
And actually, my auntie gave me a Korg M1, which at the time meant nothing to me. I was just like, it's a keyboard.
That's cool.
But that eventually became like, I realised that was kind of an iconic synth from the 80s.
Yeah.
And totally. That was me. I was obsessed.
What about yourself?
I suppose I grew up, my family were like pretty heavily involved with the church, so there was always like singing and playing in church, and so. But I think it was the moment where my uncle gave me a Led Zeppelin record.
Oh, that's formative. How old were you at that stage?
I must have been 11 or something, 11 or 12 again.
Yeah.
But, you know, all the kind of mythology is what drew me in at first. All the kind of Aleister Crowley stuff and Jimmy Page and the cult. Because I was a good Christian boy, I wasn't allowed to listen to any of that stuff or, you know.
And Led Zeppelin, because they've got songs like, you know, Ramble On, which is Where the Shire People Dwell.
They talk about the Rings. Gollum, I think, is name checked in Ramble On, isn't it?
Wait. Yeah, yeah.
What's that Led Zeppelin video, Song Remains the Same? Where they're all dressed up like a Knights Templar and that?
Yeah, they do. They have these little fantasy sequences. Robert Plant, he's kind of a knight rescuing a damsel in distress. Manager Peter Grant's like a kind of gangster, like shooting up werewolves and multicolored blood spews out of their head and stuff like that.
I'm not sure that one's for me.
And I kind of taught myself to play guitar just listening to Zeppelin records. And
what did your family think, like listening to music that that didn't glorify the occult, but Jimmy Page was definitely into Aleister Crowley.
My dad thought it was rebelliousness, but it wasn't. It was just fascination. It was just like, you know, because being brought up with the Bible and Jesus and all that cool stuff, I just wanted to know a bit about the other side, and it kind of drew me in a little bit more.
I grew up in a very Catholic family. Where both my grannies were like, you know, go to mass like every single day. Like they wanted, I think one of my grannies wanted to make, or like sort of groom me to be a priest. You know, when I was older.
Don't and use the word groom around.
Yeah, well, like, I think that I use it, I mean that in the more innocent, innocent way.
Yeah. I also grew up in a heavily Catholic family, by the way, just for disclosure.
So, like, when I'd watch Neighbours at like 5:30 waiting for my mum to come by, it's like, you know, turn that off, that's immoral.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Whoa. Like, you wouldn't even get as far as The Simpsons.
There was a fair bit of shagging in Neighbours, to be fair.
There was, like, for 5:30, wasn't it?
I know. It was, do you know what I mean? Spicy, eh?
Shagging. Yeah. I love that word.
Was there stuff that you weren't allowed to watch? Or,
oh, yeah. Was it that like, hardcore? I wasn't allowed to watch Carry On stuff or Benny Hill, you know, growing up. And
oh, come on.
I know. And I used to, like, stay up after they thought I'd gone to bed and watch Spitting Image. Remember that? The puppet show?
Yeah.
On a Sunday night and... Yeah.
So tell me about the first bands that you've played in before churches, like, because I know you've been in bands before churches.
You mean like the very first bands?
Yeah.
The
definitely.
School bands and stuff.
Yeah. I love hearing about the school bands because you've almost always got a ridiculously bad name.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I've got a great one. Bad. Like you're in a school band. Really, really bad name. My school band was called Dead Cat Lettuce.
Oh my god, that's pretty bad. Was there a reason behind it?
Or was worse, but it's quite bad.
It's quite bad, isn't it? I drew a wee logo with like a wee cat's head with X's in its eyes. We played like covers. We did like a heavy metal cover of Hanging Tough by New Kids. The school disco.
My band was called the Hot Rocks. When we were like,
it's quite good.
It's not bad, man.
From like smoking weed.
Yeah.
And smoking ash.
I have no idea what you're talking about. we were only 15. No, we named it after like the one of the boys' dads had like Rolling Stones, and I think they had a Hot
they
Rocks
did,
album.
The compilation.
Right. And they decided, right, let's call our band the Hot Rocks.
That's a good name.
It's good. That's you should not be ashamed of that.
What
at all.
About yours?
It was the same band that formed at school, began as Room 32.
Okay.
Because we rehearsed in that classroom, how original, and changed it to Julia 13, and then I stuck with that band until I was like 21, maybe.
Julia 13, 20. That's all right. It sounds kind of sci-fi.
Yeah, we're kind of like, we just wanted to be Radiohead so much.
That's when we first started working together.
Yeah, that's the first time I ever met him, and we made some bad decisions. I mean, really... We really thought that we had all this. We thought we were the biggest band in the world. We were doing that whole, if you believe you're the biggest band in the world, then you're just gonna like become it. And
we did that too.
Right?
Didn't work for
us. We ended up sacking Scotland's most powerful management company.
What?
Because we were like, we'd written this demo. We were like 18, 19.
Yeah.
And they were saying develop, and we were like,
we're already developed.
Right?
Yeah.
Me and the guy, Johnny, that were writing the songs, were like, fuck this shit, man. We're going to go in, we'll play them this, we'll play them these songs, and if they don't say, that's it, you're ready, we're going to get you a record deal right now, we'll fucking sack them on the spot. And we did. It was the stupidest thing that I've ever done.
I like
in my
that
life.
Though, it's confidence and swagger, you know.
That's, whatever. Yeah, I like it.
And it's not the tunes were good, by the way.
Yeah.
Let me just say that there were some really good tunes. So you had the stuff to back it up.
Well,
what did they say when you sacked them? Because I don't think they expected an 18-year-old, 19-year-olds to come into a big company and just go, get your coat. You're gone.
They were.
This is my office.
I think they realized that we were, in that moment, just how unready we were to be a band.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, we thought these guys might need a couple of years. Oh, this might never actually happen.
Oh. Yeah.
They're absolutely tuned to the moon.
So what happened after that? Did you get more management or did you just slowly disintegrate?
I had a local guy managing us and we just gave it. It was one of those things where, you know, you end up feel like you're pushing a rock up a hill, and I still will always love those guys. In fact, Johnny Scott, who plays drums in churches now, was in the band. So I guess that's a little part of the story that still remains. But there was, they were my best friends in school, so it just kind of came to its natural conclusion.
Yeah.
And then I was poached by him just out of uni to engineer on an Aerogram record as this rookie, and I thought, oh my god, it's because I'm literally so talented that this guy wants to just pull me out of uni and like get me working on the record. I now realise that it's probably because I was like really a lot cheaper than any other engineer. Yeah. They were trying to get an album done.
You know the real answer.
No, wait, that was looking into the sky, by the way. No, it was because when we were doing, we were working on stuff with Julia 13, and I was just really taken by how well we collaborated on arrangements and stuff in the studio, and I was like, I need this guy to make this record. I was very high at the time.
And then the love affair between you two began there then?
That was it, yeah.
So, like, you make that record, and then what? Like, it's starting to like write music together, because I know you played in the Twilight.
No, actually, we didn't end up writing music together until just at the beginning of this, at the beginning of Churches 2011. Yeah. We'd worked in bands before, but it was other people's songs. You know, like with Aerogram and stuff, it was Craig B was the main songwriter, and we were kind of producing and arranging and doing keyboards and guitars and stuff, but it wasn't like sitting down and collaborating and stuff. Mm. But when we finally got round to doing that, like Martin was out on the road with another band for quite some time, and we could never really align our diaries to kind of get in the studio and do it. But we finally did in 2011, and it's kind of like lightning striking, not to overplay it, you know.
Yeah.
You were out with the Twilight Sad.
That's right.
At that point, I was playing with them.
I think, what should I say actually about that now? Because they got upset with me apparently. Because I said that I felt rejected when I tried to join the band and they wouldn't let me, but so I don't mean to offend them, but it was really a lot of fun. Yeah. I considered them really like my brothers for a long time, and it was hard at times, of course it was, because it was a level of touring that can really, really take its toll on you emotionally and physically, but I feel like everything I learned about real touring, about hardcore touring, I learned from being in that band, and I'll always love them.
That surely made it easier when you started on the touring for Churches.
Well, yeah, it did. It really did. Although I wasn't to understand that there was a whole other like level above that again. It was just like all sorts of different stresses and things that you cannot possibly prepare for.
Where's my bagel?
I'll never be that guy, but I'll be the guy like hanging by a thread in the first 6 months of the band, because your entire world has shifted on its axis overnight, and just like 100 yards down the road is everything you've ever wanted.
Yeah.
And it's like, how you've rounded the keeper. What, how do I shot? Not balloon this? Like, do you know what I mean? And that was the anxiety and stress of that at the beginning of this band. Really, I struggled with that. Yeah.
I was going to say, like, were you ready for everything to take off as fast as
nobody
it did?
Can ever really be ready for that, though. Like Martin says, it really turns you upside down on your head. And if there's any kind of weakness or chink in the armor, you can guarantee that'll bring it out, you know? So that whole first kind of couple of years was just like a learning curve, wasn't it? It was just like,
it feels us, like you like did all
work together and tour together.
You did a lot of that learning before you got there, really, because like you all played in different bands, and Lauren played in different bands as well. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you put the first track up online, I think it went up on Neon Gold's
Neon
blog.
Gold, good memory.
And yeah, it just completely blew up from there. I think The Mother That We Share was the first track that I heard. I had it sent to me by my friend Ali McRae.
Oh, yeah.
He's like a great guy.
Good old Ali.
Yeah, very, very early on. And he was like, I'm not going to do an impression, because not only will I offend you and Ali, but also the country of Scotland. But he was really excited, and only the way that Ali can be. And he was like, you need to listen to this. This is so good. And it was Mother We Share. And I think I still stick it on from time to time, which is definitely the sign of a really good song.
Oh, that's cool. Thanks, Ali was on our band so quickly. Mm. He actually put on, he used to have this night detour Scotland.
That's right.
And he put on, it must have been in maybe the second or the third show, something like that. Really, really early.
Yeah.
And that was, there's still footage of that floating around somewhere.
And you had the songs and everything to back it up. It wasn't like you were a hype band that has to go away and struggle to go and record all the rest. At least it didn't seem like that on the surface.
Well, people kept
saying
that, though. Every single interview, it was like the words hype and buzz were used all the time. Yeah. You start to believe after a while.
Well, the thing about it
not
was,
many people can withstand that hype. Normally that hype comes and goes, and then that's it.
I think we had, and I don't mean to sound like we were totally in control, because I don't believe that we were, but what we did have was a really clear idea that we wanted to have basically a record in the can before anyone heard a note. And we had been working together for months and months and months and months, because I was obsessed with blog culture at the time, obsessed with the Hype Machine. Everything I found from, like, it was the glory days of SoundCloud.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw it again and again and again. One band writes a song, puts it out, massive overnight, nothing happens.
Yeah.
And I've seen it so many times that I was like, we cannot make this mistake. This is, everybody's fallen at the first hurdle here. And we basically wrote Bones. We had 8 or 9 songs that eventually were on Bones of What You Believe before we put Lies out, which was the first song.
Yeah.
Speculating that, hey, maybe this goes somewhere, and if it does, we're going to be ready for this part of it. By the time we came to sign all the record deals, it was like, there's an album.
But I don't think it really makes sense, and I don't understand why artists do it. Like, bands and artists and people who make music in general are just itchy to get it out. Well, most people are, anyway, are just itchy to get it out. Like, you know, they'll record it on a Thursday and then they'll want it released on the Friday.
To go for a drink, can't you?
That's we're getting signed on Wednesday.
Chilled on Sunday.
But they just want it out straight away. So the first time you got on stage and played as the band, because you went and played a couple of shows without the name Churches.
Shark Week.
Shark Week.
Well, this was another part of the plan. We were called Shark Week Guy because... That's a good name.
It's pretty good.
There was obvious barriers towards
copyright barriers.
But I guess there's another part of our preparation for coming into the world was that we wanted to get a couple of gigs done under a fake name, because suddenly there was this attention on the band.
Yeah.
That was unexpected, but also we knew that people would be at the first show, and as it turns out, the first Churches show was crazy. It was sold out. Half of London had come up. There was people trying to sign us on the day because they saw everybody else on the plane. But we wanted to be sure that we weren't, for the first time we ever got on a stage, was like, this kind of scrum. And so we did it. We turned up. This guy, lovely guy in Scotland, you probably know him, Dave McGeechan, who's been our promoter's rep from day one. I've known him for years and years. He's at DF Concerts.
Yeah.
And we asked him for a bit of a baptism of fire, like put us on the crazy, like the worst bill you could imagine our band being on, somewhere in Dunfermline.
Yeah.
And then put us on a gig that'll be really, really quiet. And that's what we did.
The word got out though, didn't it?
Eventually, and then it got a wee bit, it was kind of added to the hype or whatever, so maybe we kind of knew what we were doing, I don't know. But we did get a chance to play a couple of gigs before suddenly there was all this attention on us, and I'm glad, because we were kind of shit. Let's be honest, let's have it right.
Well, see, we're getting better now, but we were shit.
Exactly. By the fifth album, we'll just be like completely where we need to be.
Like, we're ready.
Everybody's left. So, okay, cool.
What were the conversations like that you were having with people in the music industry around those times? Because I always think that, like,
oh god, you must write a book about it.
Had a lot of meetings.
It was wild.
It was awful.
I didn't pay for a dinner for about 2 months. That was kind of the best bit about it.
There was one particularly memorable one where a couple of guys came up from London. I can't even remember what label they were with.
That's probably for the best.
Exactly. They dragged us like all the way across Glasgow to somewhere we didn't really want to be, in order so that he could score some coke in the back of the pub. You know, that's the kind of stuff. You know, it's just like, come on,
friends, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. But I thought that's kind of. I thought that era had passed. You know?
I didn't think that that sort of like behavior still kind of like happens. I thought it was a very sort of like 90s thing, and then that was it.
I mean, I guess it was still there on some level when we started. But the interesting thing, I guess, in the end is that the first guy that made a serious offer on the band was Nick Burgess.
Yeah.
And we went round all the houses, met everybody, and then eventually signed with Nick Burgess anyway, because he was still that guy before anyone else saying, I believe in this band. And he's been our A&R over those 3 records, and we ended up becoming really close, and he's a great guy, and I trust him. And it's unusual that you should be able to say that about a label, but and in the US we signed with Daniel Glass, who it was a really similar experience. He flew his entire family to to London on Thanksgiving yeah. and was like, when
that
you
sounds
sing,
like emotional blackmail.
Right? Well, he turns up at this show.
You cannot sign us, my right? children, indeed.
It was genius because he turns up at the show and he says, when you sign with me, this is what you get. This isn't
family.
This mm-hmm. is yeah. this is it's real. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And I'm the president of the label. And I'm unfireable. You know what I mean? And I was like, you know what? Let's go. That's, and we've had a great working relationship with Glasnost too.
I was going to say, that's pretty hard to turn down because I think with people in... And this is what I say, kind of say to bands as well, because there's certain bands assigned to majors and I don't think they should. Because you need to have that person in there fighting your corner. It's like you signed to this company, right? But there's such a high turnaround in that industry that by the time that you get to the first album, that person that brought you in might be gone, and then the next person might not give a shit.
Yeah,
it's true.
And it's a really common story.
Okay, right, a little break in the conversation for a second. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast so far. If you're arsed and you want to, and I'm sure you've been asked a million times before, but if this is the one time you do it, please do it. Give the podcast a little rating and a review on whatever platform it is you're listening to it, preferably Apple Podcasts. I'd love you for life. Thank you so much. Also, if you want to follow me and suggest some guests or ask any questions or get in contact at all, then you can get me at Philly Taggart on Instagram and Twitter. I'm currently booking guests for season 2. I've got about like 8 or 9 already. And honestly, some of the names that we've got in there for season 2 is ridiculous. Also, I really want to talk about the Slacker Live Tour. Outside of the podcast and the Slacker book and all the rest of it, God, I'm putting Slacker to everything. There'll be Slacker pregnancy tests soon enough, won't there? The Slacker Night was born out of playing live and getting bands to play live and throwing massive parties. So I'm throwing a couple of massive parties in February on the 20th, 21st and 22nd in Reading, Southampton and Margate. So I'm going to come and DJ, but the most important bit of this is I've got the sickest band that are coming with me on that tour as well. They are called The Magic Gang and they're going to be playing live in Reading, Southampton, Margate on the 20th, 21st and 22nd of February, and I will link to tickets in the description below. Okay, so we're getting back into part 2 of the podcast with Churches, where we talk about everything from video games to synth addictions to Breaking America to the third album to political consciousness and to online abuse. We'll get into it all in the second part, and here it is. What was the big track that you guys wrote when you were getting the first record together that you were like, oh, boom, this is the one?
I think it was Lies. Mm.
That was the first single, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, and I don't... And people still bring this up, but I definitely didn't know that we had something like The Mother We Share on our hands, even after we wrote it.
Uh-huh.
The night before The Mother We Share was released online with James Passmore, we were rearranging the song. Like,
really?
Double time, chopping verses, moving it around. I swear, I got like wholesale changes.
We knew there was something like, in there, but it didn't feel like we'd arrived. Submit it.
Does that mean that you're happy with the version that went out?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
It's like, and you can, I've said this before, but you can only ever have one like breakthrough moment.
Uh-huh.
So I'll always love that song. I'll never be the guy like that's in any way sick of that song, because it's kind of was the linchpin in
totally
what's become a 3-album career, you know?
I guess that like you're not that sort of Lee Mavers style character that has to work on an album and like over and over and over again. And then, like, you know, can't figure out which way to mix it and stuff. Yeah. If you've reached 3 albums by the stage, you think that you probably haven't got that in you, have you?
George Lucas of synth pop.
Yeah.
I think the nature of the way that we work together makes sure that none of that happens. You know, I think that maybe one or the other of us has got tendencies towards, like, you know, going back and want to fix stuff and, like, you know, working on stuff. And
We have complementary personalities in that respect.
It's like, okay, this is done already. Let's get it.
Yeah. I think that Ian is really, really, his attention to detail is like no one else I've ever known, and I just need constant immediacy.
Yeah.
And I think that we kind of meet in the middle, and that's how you know when something's finished, and it gets like things to a kind of good state of
No, but I think there's always a point completion towards the end of that process where the roles flip. I think that right before it's done, you're like Mr. Magnifying Glass, really, really getting into the fine details of the mix and the arrangement, and I'm just like, this is done, it's done, let's get it out. Do you know what I mean? It's a weird dynamic, but it works.
That's probably true.
It works.
Who put the V in Churches?
Jesus. I don't know. I think that do you know, that's another thing that we did. That's another thing that we did. Then, literally right before Mother went online,
yeah,
we changed it. The U to the V. We had like a summit, and we were like, we gotta do something about this U. Like, no one can find us on there.
Nobody's gonna be able to do it. Like,
church band.
What I said was true.
I used to play a band called the 1930s. When,
the 1935s?
And I'd Google them, like, you know, find out some information or tour dates or something. This is back when I was starting in Northern Ireland. Mm. And you just, like, it would just bring up pictures of, like, kids with a hoop and a stick.
It was really
and you're like, right, yeah. Okay. Yeah. You need to have a Googleable band mm-hmm. name, don't you?
It's true.
And that was...
Do people call you Chiverches?
Oh, yeah.
Every day.
All the time?
I'm cool with it.
We kind of call ourselves Chiverches. I do that as well.
So then, like, the debut album, like, you know, you've got it written, you've signed it all up, and it comes out, and then you hit the road. What was it like? What was the dynamic like with the three of you touring? Because, like, you've all done your touring in the past together, but... I'd imagine, like, you would have a very different dynamic with you three than maybe the previous acts that you were in.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this was the first time that I'd ever been in a band where the power dynamic was so finely balanced.
Yeah.
It was like a proper...
Is there normally like
one, two, three on the same level? And I'd only ever experienced, like, roles where that was kind of
different.
There's
a leader and then there's subservience.
Yeah. Yeah.
In some ways, that's easier, isn't it?
Oh, it's much easier. It's a lot easier to make decisions. They're not always good decisions, but mm-hmm. they're decisions get made.
Does mm-hmm. that mean you guys butt heads on decisions from time to time? Where you've got
once
like
in a while.
Three
not
people
who've
got three different visions?
But I think it's a fine balance, like Doc says, and I think it needs like constant care and management. You know, I think when things get neglected, they tend to kind of fall apart quite quickly.
Mm. Yeah.
But I think that, you know, we're all pretty good at communicating now, and I think that that sounds like a cliche, but it's absolutely essential.
Is it not hard to communicate when you're all... Are you all in the same city? Whereabouts are you around the world? I know Lauren's in New York, isn't she?
We've all been living in New York
since
the start of last year.
Yeah, you think this is nonsense, but it's true. I literally live 96 paces from Lauren's front door. It's like, what could be more Glasgow than that? Like, you've got all of New York to pick, and you're like, I'll just move my mate.
I could live in Brooklyn, I could live in Harlem, right. I could go live up wherever.
Yeah. And Ian was there as well up until very recently, but I guess we don't live anywhere now. That's
Once you flip into the tour mode, do you like let the leases in your apartments go and just go, right?
Well, I have, yeah. It's like,
there's not much
in
point,
New York
is there?
It's so fucking expensive.
Yeah.
It's basically like having the most expensive storage unit in the world.
You know? Please stop talking. I'm sweating right now. I'm like thinking about it. I'm like, I've got a lease on till like September. I'm stressing me out.
Fine. Yeah, but
it's a great place to have as a base, though, between things. You know?
Will you go back there after you're finished on tour, or will you go back to Scotland?
This is going to sound like the most cliche guy ever, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to go to LA.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Well, exactly. And
what takes you there?
I think I started to do a fair bit of writing as well, and I'm finding a little bit of success. Ian and I actually did this thing with a girl, Sasha Sloan, who's immensely talented.
Oh, yeah, I've heard her. She's really good.
Yeah, so I got a couple of cuts with her, and Ian got a cut with her as well. And it's I just think there's so much opportunity out there.
Does that mean that when everything calms down, or even on the road, do you guys write for other people?
Not yet. We haven't done any of that while we've been touring.
I tend to do it in the downtime.
Yeah.
Because I just need to be constantly stimulated in that way. Because if I have 2 weeks off, I just don't know what to do with myself and I end up in the pub. Not like I'm like have a problem with it or anything. I just really feel the need to be creatively engaged
and doing
something.
And if you're not, then you're in the pub.
Yeah. And that's the road to like depression and self-loathing.
That change of pace is crushing, actually.
Yeah.
The same way, like if you're used to being like in one place and then all of a sudden you're everywhere, that change of pace is hard too.
Uh-huh.
But I almost think it's harder when you've suddenly got nothing and nowhere to be.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh my God, what is my life?
But when you've built in so much routine and so much structure, someone turns it off, like turning off a light.
You're like, what time do I go to sleep at?
What the hell am I supposed to do? And it's a really odd feeling where you need to,
must
like,
be like coming out of the army or something.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah, I imagine so.
And you know, it's really easy to find your way into a pub when that's the scenario, because you're like, oh, well, I've got nothing else to do.
Mm. Yeah, may as well.
Yeah, but
it's more like video games though.
Yeah, this is
I love computer games. Computer games and football is like my switch off. Like I don't know about you, but like I'm not very good under stress. Like I'm just I get stressed and I end up being a bit of a dick, and I'm just like, right.
I know that feeling. I'll tell you.
I need, yeah, like, you know, when you're up there and you're it's basically like somebody who's pouring you a coffee, and then all the hot, it doesn't stop, and all the hot water flows out over onto your hand.
That's a really good way to describe it.
That's basically stress for me. Yeah. So I just play shit loads of FIFA.
Yes, me too. Me too. I'm PS4? Obsessed with it. PS4, right?
I'm going to get your gamer tag and play tonight.
Yes, love it. I had like 1,200 hours in Destiny by the time I...
1,200 hours?
By the time I finished playing it, yeah.
And that's like a job.
I know. Because I'm exactly the same.
You switch
totally throw myself into video games, something that can just turn when we're recording.
Yeah,
I don't want to listen to music. Mm. I don't want to talk to people. I just want to look at a screen for like 5 hours and then go to sleep.
Forget, yeah,
you should
yeah.
get into an MMO. I think that's what you should do.
I think that's a terrible idea.
What's that? An MMO?
Yeah, like a massively multiplayer online. You know, like World of Warcraft or Final Fantasy like 14.
Fortnite's a big one at the minute, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a more of a kind of shooter, though.
I'm right into Fortnite, I tell you that.
Oh, yeah, like what? Oh, yeah, okay, so role-playing and stuff
role-playing,
like that.
Role-playing, yeah.
Are you into those?
Yeah, I really like Final Fantasy 14. Like
is that what number we're up to now?
I know.
We're in 15. 15 now.
It's like Jaws 12.
Jaws 12.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can just lose yourself in those games, and it's, you know, I don't know if it's good for your head.
Well, I'd almost take the other side on that, because I you know, I don't believe everything you read, but I totally understood it when I was reading this article last week that playing computer games for a certain length of time a week was more useful to people who suffered from anxiety and depression than actual counselling.
Okay, controversial.
It feels like a clickbaity sort of headline, but like I kind of understand why. If you are completely focusing on a computer game, your brain, the side of your brain, probably just like, you know, fizzes about all the time and is worried. It's like going, oh, I've got to pay for that. Oh, it's god, like, well, yeah, exactly. I'm a hypochondriac. Oh god, what the fuck's going on? And then you're just focused in on this one thing, and it completely levels it out.
You know, well, I certainly explored that course of action thoroughly. I say it definitely works. I don't know if it takes any of the problems away, but you certainly can forget about them, you know?
The counseling or the computer games?
The computer games.
So, we were talking about synths earlier on, like that sort of synth addiction that I imagine you have. Like, I'm not sure if you do have it, but, like... Are there synths all over your studio? Broken synths, fixed synths, new synths?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's what I'd imagine.
Wall-to-wall synths.
Yeah, the home base in Glasgow has, it's like just racks of all synthesizers. I think we got really inspired by a picture we saw of M83, remember that? Years and years ago. And he had a similar setup, and I was like, I want that.
He had
like a Roland Jupiter 8 and all these synths that I've been using when I was coming through on the computer. And that was kind of in our minds. It was like, I don't want to use software synthesizers. I want to get the real thing. And that was like a kind of amazing graduation once we could afford the synths that we'd been using on a screen for
album two budget life. Was basically because we made it ourselves.
It
was basically all on gear.
All on synths. But like when you get that budget and you spend it all on synths, you get to keep that as well. So like that's always like, because you hear about bands building their own studios and stuff, and you're like, that's the smartest thing you can kind of do, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
But which one's your favorite? This is for the synth nerds that are listening.
Favorite synth of all time is the one that I currently play on stage, which is the Minimoog Model D, which is a reissue of the kind of classic version of the Minimoog from the 70s. It's just perfect in every single way. It sounds like nothing else, eh?
It's unbelievable. But mine's is the Jupiter 8 for sure, for the reasons that I was just describing. I wanted this synth so much, like I was obsessed with it. And it is really, really expensive, but it was kind of like a rite of passage to buy it.
Yeah,
I used it so much.
Grand?
Something like that. I used it so much on the second album. Every single song.
You flipping want to use it for that price,
I know.
that Ian like literally banned it. We never even flew it to New York. That's how much it was hardcore barred from this.
Yeah,
album.
It's the sound of album too. I know.
You're like, guys, right? We need to switch this up for the new.
And because I just found it to just be everything that I wanted. I was like, it's there. Quicker. Okay, let's go.
So we're working on the third album. It's the first time you've started working with other producers on it. Why come? Do you not trust yourselves that much?
No. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
We were kind of. That conversation had started at the beginning of the album three sessions between us, that it might be interesting to open it up to collaborators and that we should maybe engage in some of that as an experiment. Mm-hmm. And we could easily have gone through 10 and it hadn't worked and we would have moved on. But midway through that exploration, we took a session with Greg and kind of...
Who's Greg?
Greg Kirsten.
Yeah.
And it just felt so right and so energizing, and everything that we did felt like it, that we were excited to be in the studio, and there was this real atmosphere about the place, and he had a way about him that just complemented everything we do. He didn't try and be a producer. He didn't try and come in and be like, look, guys, this is where you've been going wrong, because he knew that would never work with us.
Yeah,
we didn't think what it was going wrong, and I still don't. We were just experimenting with the idea if there was someone could come in and enhance the dynamic that we already had going.
So he's kind of like enabling more than anything else, and just like taking it to the next, well, not the next level, but adding his sheen to it. Because
I think he was more like in at the roots of the songs, like his actual parts and stuff were really inspiring us to up our game as well. You know, with the melodies.
Did you have to go through a lot of people to get to him?
We took a few sessions before it, and then we cancelled everything after it.
Yeah, really? Did you have like one where you were just like, this is Soul Destroyer and I don't want to ever do this?
Yeah. There's one, and I'll never forget it, and I'll never go back there.
Because I've worked with artists before, and we've had to put them in with songwriters, more like acoustic-y folk people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, yeah, like you get a phone call afterwards going, why the fuck did you put me in with him?
Yeah.
Like, funny that. I was like, sorry.
Yeah.
We'll not do it again.
I think that we could have been there for months and not got that guy's attention.
How do you deal with American music industry? Because, like, they're very, people that work in music in America are very straightforward. They're very, like, okay, so that song's shit. And we're not going to be doing that. I don't know. I come from Ireland, and there has to be a bit of patter,
a bit of massaging,
right? A bit of patter beforehand. You know, like how's the going? How's the wife? How's the dog?
Yeah.
All the rest of it.
And this song shit.
Yeah.
It's funny. Our manager has this phrase, like when we're working with people that or new people that start working with the band, he'll use the phrase. This person doesn't speak band very well. Do you know what I mean by that? It's like, there's a way that you have to address the band, okay?
Even when band asks you for the truth, they
baby
don't
gloves,
really mean
I
the truth. Get the kit gloves on, and that's it.
Yeah,
kit
gloves.
But no, the Americans, you know, this is really boring, but we have an unbelievable relationship with that label. And it's like an independent deal, but they don't feel like an independent record label. Well, they do inside the office and the way they communicate, but they can really give you a go out there in the way that they promote.
Very connected.
And they're very and they work as hard for you as you work for them.
Uh-huh.
And we went out and we hammered it in the touring, and they saw that investment in time and energy, and they committed on the same level.
Mm. Well, you've legit broke in America now is like more so than any other bands over here in the last while, apart from maybe the 1975.
Yeah, I mean, that's I guess it's in hindsight now I realize the gravity of what was happening at the time.
Yeah,
but we were just so incapable of looking outside of the bubble, and I think that's probably a good thing that I look back. But what I now realize is that Daniel and the rest of Glassnote saw that commitment, and they went just as hard and managed to push the band through, and we've ended up enjoying really great live out there, and the albums sell well there, and I'm really grateful for that. But nothing has changed. We're about to go there and slam it for the whole autumn, and then
and you've
we'll
got
be back round again next summer, and that's it, and it doesn't stop. And
you've got amazing songs to go into. It's like you're almost your poppiest record yet. Miracle is a huge, huge, huge tune.
Yeah, we wrote that with Steve, actually.
Yeah.
That's the one part of the story that sometimes gets left out, is that we had this amazing experience with Greg, and we've written a bunch of songs ourselves, and some of those made the record, and then right at the last minute, it was the Miracle is the classic, your album's done, do you want to take this session, and we'll just see what develops.
Yeah.
And we went to London and met Steve Mack, who happened to be just a really incredible guy, really real attention to detail, very, very talented. I don't think I've ever met anyone with the same kind of killer instinct that he has in the studio for melody and for a hit. Uh-huh. And we took the session, we wrote Miracle, and then all the labels...
Right, guys, we need to put this on.
And the labels start freaking out. And
that's exactly what happened.
And,
yeah.
And that's exactly how that came about. Yeah.
Holy crap. It's amazing when that happens, isn't it?
Yeah,
like, it's just like lightning in a bottle, but like almost after it's meant to have passed.
Do you know, there's one thing that I regret about the Steve sessions. What's is that? That we almost wrote a ballad with him. Like when we were done, like the high five will come in, we'll write a ballad, because who does not want to write a ballad with a guy that wrote Flying Without Wings? To me, that is like the peak of balladry, right? Like,
yeah.
And he ended up writing the ballad himself, and like Celine Dion cut it.
Maybe that's for the best then.
I know.
Do you know, I don't know, man.
Like, do you have to turn down collaborators now? Because like, I'd imagine like maybe even working in the States a lot, there's a lot of, because you're big worldwide now, I'm sure there's a lot of people that want to work with you.
Lauren's vocal is like catnip for EDM producers. Mm. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of offers in that world.
You must be turning down big figures as well. Well, they're probably not so much now, but like when the EDM heyday of a couple of years ago, you must have been going, right, David Guetta wants you on his track. Avicii wants you on the track. And yeah. You know, just like all the big EDM producers of the day would want
there was
Lauren
a bit of that,
on the track.
If I'm honest, yeah, but we never even got as far as talking money or anything with those guys, because we were very, very,
you were just not
very
not
sure that it was not on the table in any way. You know, I think we've chilled out a lot that, and the years of progression and establishing our identity, we're more relaxed. Whereas in the beginning, if someone had said, "Hey, do you want to take a session with any producer?" I'd be, "Fuck you!
Yeah,
don't fuck with my heart. Don't touch me.
Here's Fiverr. Give me $750.
Yeah. And I guess it was coming from a place of insecurity. Now that I think about it,
yeah.
But for wherever it was coming from, I think it ended up being a real strength to the band, because it looked real. And I was like, who are these? This guy and this weird guy and this girl. And like, what is this band? And as the story unraveled, people could figure out that this is a really, was as real as it gets. And
it's doing our own thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I can never see you guys or Lauren just bowing for something just for a check or anything like that. You're all very principled in what you do.
Yeah. It's hard sometimes, by the way.
Yeah. I'd imagine it was. It was like about four years ago. I remember Lauren was writing a piece for The Guardian, and she was going on Channel 4 and talking about all the sexism that was aimed at her around that time. Like it must have been difficult for you guys as friends, more so than bandmates, to see all that stuff going on.
It's absolutely horrible when one of your best friends and very, very close colleagues has to go through stuff like that. For her art, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, it's just kind of unspeakable, the things that she had to put up with. And I don't really think it's changed that much. I mean, I think that the discussion...
Do you not think so? I
think the discussion is a lot more mainstream now, which is great. And,
but actually,
that's definitely progress. Mm-hmm. But the behaviour of anonymous on the internet hasn't changed at all, you know?
I think that if you tackle something like that at its base with like young people, then you know it's only going to get better after time.
I agree with that.
Having people, the keyboard warriors, like they will always be there, and they will always be in their droves as well. But it's really just hard to deal with, I suppose, when you're in the public eye like you guys are.
It was tremendously difficult to watch that happening. And we stood with her, and we were doing everything we could behind the scenes to just make sure she felt like we were on her team and that she had free rein to say whatever she wanted to say. Because at that time, speaking out about misogyny was a really risky career move.
Uh-huh.
Funny how that's changed. But at that time, it was nobody else was talking about it. And that isn't to say that there wasn't movements in the past.
Uh-huh.
There was just that these things come in waves, and it was at a particular trough. And the anonymity of the internet has just created this whole subculture of really intense anger and real people feeling like they don't know how to manage their emotions, and that gets directed at the first thing that they see, that whatever reason it seems to irritate them. Mm. And
is that still there? Do you directed at you guys the same way?
I have to say that this is the truth, is that very little gets directed towards Ian and I in particular.
Yeah.
But Lauren still gets it every day. It's still intense. It's still a lot.
Is it the sexist things?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's, I guess that's why Ian said initially that he doesn't feel like anything has changed, because on the ground where we are, what we are seeing is very, very similar to what we saw then. If I'm honest, I have learned so much from my personal standpoint from being in this band with Lauren.
Yeah.
So things that because I lived in my own world and I didn't behave in a particular way or uh-huh. ever even consider it, or just be like, it was second nature to me. And then all these issues came to the surface that maybe I wasn't entirely aware of, that are now coming to the mainstream. And I think the average dude is going, oh, fuck, this was going on the whole time. Maybe they didn't have the same kind of awareness.
But you're kind of on the flip side of that. Like, when you come to a new record or you are going and doing interviews and stuff, is it something that's always brought up and people always want to talk to you about it? And how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that is something that always comes up. And I guess it's going into a conversation like that and people understand where we're coming from, understand where Lauren's coming from before they even enter the room, is a positive thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than it being the kind of classic girl in a band conversation, which I think is like...
It's one of the questions that annoys me the most.
That is just so lazy. The whole misogyny thing, the discussion, I think we've always kind of resisted making it like too much of a focus when we talk about, when we do interviews and stuff, but it's definitely something. I think it's really important to even in a small part, to raise awareness of those issues.
Sure.
and to make it more of a mainstream conversation. And I think that's something that's happening now. Yeah. And Lauren particularly has, I think, played a big part in bringing that, you know, more to the surface, and that's great. No regrets.
I think as entertainers as well, it's something that we've always been careful to not have define us, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
We're entertainers first and foremost, we're musicians, but we wouldn't be good people if we were ignoring it completely.
Yeah, but you've
I want to be an entertainer, I want to be a musician, I want to be a good person as well. You know, I need to be a human being first and foremost. And we wouldn't have been able to go on without addressing that, especially knowing how much pain Lauren was in.
Uh-huh.
And that, I guess that's where it all fell. And even it seemed like a risk at the time, and it was. Mm. But I couldn't be happier that we took it.
The thing is, if it was a risk worth doing, even if it didn't go the right way, you'd still be able to
stand by it.
Yeah.
You can stand by it.
Yeah.
As long as you can sleep at night, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Well, if it all went away on those terms, I would have been fine with it.
Yeah.
Totally. Like, if that's literally how this has to be, then I wouldn't have been able to go on as a human 100%. Being in a band, knowing that we had put somebody through that kind of pain.
You have a political conscience in general, and that's what I really sort of admire about you, because I think there's a lot more people should be doing a lot more in music than there actually is. There's a lot of mutton dresses lamb out there of people who are saying that they're political and they'll stand up for it, and then they do fuck all. I quite like when a band has got something to say. Like, you know, you live in America now. Like, you're living in America at the where there's a guy who used to be on The Apprentice as the president.
Who is a known
You got Theresa May
predator.
Over here.
Yeah.
Like, it is a really intense time to be living out there. And to be honest, New York and LA is not really representative of just where that nation is at politically.
Mm. Yeah.
But at the same time, if you turn on a television, if you look at a newspaper, if you see any kind of media, it would blow your fucking mind the way that this is reported on the ground out there.
I stick Fox on when I go out there
for lulls,
for laughs.
It is outrageous.
Like, it's just incredible.
The thing about living in America at the moment is it kind of feels like you've got ringside seats.
I try not to throw stones at American politics when I still feel so Scottish and so British, and I can see what's happening here. Like, I haven't moved there in a long time. I'm coming back to this country. It's a country I love. But it's just, this political situation here is not good.
No, it's
like,
not.
Do you know what I mean?
Not the best, is it? Like,
no. Throw stones at both and it's fine.
Okay, oh yeah, I suppose.
I saw a cover you guys did of Toto. Not a cover, but like...
A cover.
It's not a cover.
Fanny about in the studio.
You did a fanny about video in the studio.
We're working on Terminator right now as well. Me and Ian and Johnny like to play that after Recover.
Soundcheck fun.
And then we've got the Axel Foley theme.
Oh yeah, from Beverly Hills Cop.
There's loads of them coming, man. We've got like four bars of each down.
Well, that's great. Like, right? I also saw a young girl do a version of "Bury It" on your Twitter as well. Oh. There seems to be a lot of like young fans doing cover versions.
We saw
really
Medical
great,
one
and it just melts my heart.
Mate, it just, oh man, I'm reduced to just it's so nice seeing that stuff, watching it connect. Maybe I'm just like feeling old. I don't have any kids or that, so maybe I'm like, oh my god,
pretty.
You know what, that's
not
bullshit. I'm
I know
not.
You're not winding you up.
I know it's just not true, but it's very very cute when you see that. It's cool.
Actually, it was a young band. It was a band of
that's
kids.
Right,
that's yeah. Right, the
they were
family.
Really rocking out. I think the dad was on Axe or something like that,
yeah.
As well. It was like
some interesting distorted bass.
It was like a talent show or something.
Yeah, yeah, it was
that,
really cool.
That looked amazing. So yeah, like one final question, before we split. So if you were doing it all again, or you had a young cousin or something that was starting in music, and you had to give them one piece of advice,
be an accountant,
starting out a band, what would it be?
Listen more. Listen to more music. No matter how broad you think your musical vocabulary is, just keep listening, because you're gonna end up, if you get through. And you get a game, you're the sum of your musical taste, and your personality is what you're eventually going to output if you're making music that's real and true to you. So no matter how much you think you've listened enough, listen more.
Yeah, I would also say if you're really serious about it, find somebody who can be as objective as possible and as honest as possible, whether it's your pal or a family member, just like tell you exactly how good or bad what you're doing is, because it's important. You know, I think people often find people to support their kind of self-delusion, and they just end up wasting their time.
I actually think it's even more important to train that in yourself.
Yeah, like, but that's really hard.
That's really difficult. But if you can get there and you can have that unfiltered, you're just going to be, it's the best tool you could ever have.
That's true, man.
Sage advice. Guys, thank you very much.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks very much for listening to this week's podcast with Churches. If you enjoyed it, then feel free to wheel back into the 10 previous podcasts that are all up there. Last week's podcast with Hosier is probably one of my favourites. And of course, my Slacker Club night is coming to Reading, Margate and Southampton in February. And I've got the Magic Gang playing live on that tour, which is going to be the biggest party North Towns I've ever seen. You can get the tickets in the link below. Next week on the podcast, we have got the three family relatives to two brothers and a cousin. That sounds better, doesn't it? The Cribs on next week. Thank you very much. Have a good week, and I'll see you later.